Welcome to Mysterious Japan, created by Heath Havey and dedicated to the dark histories, ghost stories, and frightful folklore of Japan. These are the stories that give nightmares to the Japanese. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Mysterious Japan. This is Episode 4, Murder in the Suicide Forest. Murder may not be a word you expect to hear about a haunted forest notorious for suicide, but murder and curses have a strange place in Jukai that few Westerners have ever heard about. Part 1. The Curses of Jukai. Some enter Jukai to end their lives as part of a depraved ritual to put a curse on Japanese society and humanity. These individuals feel they have been neglected and forsaken by the world. The most well-known of these is nailed to a tree deep in the forest. Volcanologist Hayano, highlighted in the last episode, came across this curse in 2009. He showed it to a film crew and explained its meaning. A large stuffed doll is nailed to a tree like an upside-down crucifixion. The doll is a replica of Jack Skellington from the movie The Nightmare Before Christmas. The facial features have been shredded off with the stuffing puffed out. It displays only a white blank face. The spikes nailing it to the tree are as large as tent pegs. Near the doll is a plaque nailed to another tree with the same spikes. Hayano explains,
"This was done as a sign of contempt for society and to place a curse on the area and the world the person is leaving behind. The nails represent that the curse is nailed it and cannot be removed. The plaque reads, 'I came here because nothing good ever happened for me in life. Don't go looking for me.' This is a symbol of contempt for society by a person who felt tortured by society. It is not a prank."
Placing a curse on Jukai and society in general is not uncommon for those entering the forest intent on taking their own lives. These curses, sealed with their own blood, are meant to further cement Jukai's reputation as a place cursed with Datari. They believe their curses invite evil spirits or supernatural beings like demons to inhabit the forest. Similar signs are nailed to trees throughout Jukai, often conveying a final message of hate for the world. Most are carved directly into the trees. The most well-known of these is Two Channel Mona. Spray painted in red on a wide tree trunk are the words Two Channel Mona, along with the ASCII representative image of the cat-like Mona character. Mona originated on the two-channel text board community in 2000. Its name comes from a derivation of the cat's favorite phrase, "Oh my Mona," meaning "you too." Its interpretation has evolved to be negative and sarcastic, such as "not me, but you." Although intent cannot be verified with certainty, most interpretations are that the writer meant it as a curse that whatever he does to himself will also befall the reader. Not far from the two-channel Mona tree, hikers found an abandoned tent with the words "you cannot live anymore" written across the tent, along with "mama" and other graffiti. On the tree facing the tent, someone spray painted the words "I curse you." On another tree, someone spray painted the word "death." Around the tree, arrayed like an altar, is a collection of rotting food and flowers. The person leaving the curse wrapped police tape around the trunk as if to consecrate the curse. Other unexplained objects, including statues of animals like cats and religious icons such as Buddhist Jizo statues, are thought to be part of curses placed on the land. These curses lead some to believe that the screams heard in the forest are left by these bitter souls cursing the world before death. Left with unresolved rage and a wrath against humanity, they remain bound to the forest as grudge spirits. These vengeful ghosts are known as Onryo. Others believe these curses have summoned an evil spirit or demon known as an Akuryo, which literally means devil spirit. These curses add to the mysteries of this forest, but worse than curses happen there. Part 2. Sacrifice in the Forest. Jukai has long been reputed to be a place where a dark and controversial practice took place. Ubaste, a form of sinicide, Ubaste literally translates as disposing of a grandmother. In times of dire macroeconomic downturns, starvation often became rampant. Many families had too many mouths to feed. In some cases, an elderly member of the family would volunteer as a sacrifice. but sometimes they would be chosen against their will. Under Confucian principles of familial piety, this sacrifice would reduce one's burden, called meiwaku, on the family and become a practical solution to an otherwise unsolvable family crisis. The grandmother would be led, or sometimes carried, to the top of a mountain or deep in the woods where there was no food or human contact. The location would be a place where the weak or infirm would be unable to extricate themselves. For this, the dense and disorienting woods of Jukai presented the perfect setting. After abandonment, the elderly die slowly and painfully over days or weeks due to starvation, dehydration, or hypothermia. In some cases, wild animals like dogs, foxes, or the Asian black bear would get to them first. In 1783, Japan was still in the grip of a four-year famine when Mount Asama erupted. Mount Asama lies about 140 miles north of Mount Fuji. Its eruption sent ash and devastation throughout much of Japan, exacerbating a deadly famine that plagued the local villages. The eruption was followed by summer cold spells that ended in massive supply shortages for 3 years. Food shortages affected families everywhere. This would become known as the Great Tenmei Famine. The itinerant scholar Sugama Sumi traveled through the nearby villages in 1785. He reported coming across mounds of bleached bones. A peasant explained the situation to Masumi.
These are bones of those who starved to death. The bodies lined the streets in piles, but they collapsed in the snow of the last winter, blocking the roads for miles. We had to tread carefully around the bodies until finally gathering the remains into great heaps. They decayed to bones in the summer heat.
Masumi asked the peasant, "How do your people survive this famine?" The peasant said,
"For food, we first chased chickens and dogs. But when we ran out of animals, some of us stabbed and killed our own children, our brothers, or other people on death's door with disease, and we ate their flesh."
Cannibalism. Masumi was shocked. Disturbed by the peasant's statement, Masumi quickly moved on. He eventually came upon a local samurai and told him the tale. He didn't believe they resorted to cannibalism. It was too cruel, too barbaric. The samurai confirmed the story.
"All we had to eat was horse flesh, and when that ran out, we ate cats and dogs. In some villages, not one person out of 50 households survived. We could not track who had died because the corpses were unburied and eaten by wild animals."
When Masumi inquired of the local authorities, they reported over 64,000 deaths from the 3 years of famine. Masumi reported these numbers and practices in his official records. As a scholar, he returned home enlightened, yet concern over what humans will do in desperate times consumed him. In 1833, 50 years after Masumi recorded his story, another famine devastated Japan. The Tempo famine came after years of unusual cold and wet spells, resulting in massive crop failures. Starting in the northeast, the famine reached all of Japan, including the Jukai area. It affected all crops, including rice, wheat, barley, and even bamboo. One bad season was difficult enough, but the shortage continued for 3 more years until 1836. One commentator recorded that 1836 was, quote, infinitely worse, with incessant rain and cold and a harvest only 28% of normal. He described the ground being littered with great heaps of skulls, bones, clothes, and other relics of the dead that created a monument to the famine. He said,
"During this time, the poor and the beggars died in such numbers they could not be interred in the usual manner. Instead, they were cremated by the hundreds on piles of brushwood."
Rice prices skyrocketed to 3 times normal, and families died from starvation. The exact number of dead is unknown, but historians estimate that between 100,000 to 200,000 perished in the famine. Many more lived in extreme duress for the next 10 years until at least 1846. These two great famines created abysmal family conditions and culminated in the need for desperate measures, including the practice of yuba stay. Recently, a woman local to Jukai commented,
"The shocking practice of yuba stay to reduce mouths to feed was clearly practiced in this region. I know this because the names, graveyards, and family temples of the people actually abandoned are here. There are also two caves used for abandonment. I visited one of them called Bamba Ana. The entrance is about 2 meters wide and descends about 20 meters. It was reported in 1978 that it then extends horizontally for 1,000 meters. Bears approach this place, so be careful if you go too deep and don't go alone. If so, you go at your own risk.
Indeed, the hole itself has been cordoned off and access is currently prohibited. At its bottom, authorities found human bones dating back to at least the 19th century. According to one legend associated with this hole, if you visit at night, the spirit of an old woman appears, and if you step too closely, a hand will reach out of the hole and drag you down to your death. Within Jukai, restless spirits are said to roam. Anubis Day is considered by locals to be one reason Jukai transformed from a place of mystical and religious power to a place where spirits are bound to the earth, unable to move on. These spirits, they believe, cry out for help or try to prevent souls from leaving the forest, enticing them to join the dead as proxies for the family members who abandon them to a slow and painful death without giving them the Buddhist death rites. Many say they hear the moans of starving old people left in the woods, crying out for food and water, for family, and for help. These are souls who never received their last Buddhist rites. They are bound to the earth because they believe they cannot receive Buddhahood after death without these rites. And thus the elderly abandoned here bind their souls to Jukai in despair. And so we can see that many innocent souls are believed to have been abandoned in Jukai to die slowly and miserably because of the burden on their family. But this happened centuries ago. Some would argue it was not murder, but just desperation. And the curses, what about them? They are not the equivalent of murder. But beyond the curses and beyond abandoning family members in the forest to die, Jukai is known to be a place of modern day murder.
Up close, I see that the blood covering the right side of his body did not come from any wound. It was not his blood. In the other hand, he holds a blood-covered hunting knife. He grins, and his eyes seem empty as he takes a step toward me. I just scream and push past him. Running out the door, howling bloody murder. It was dumb and reckless, and it probably surprised him, but it saved my life that day. That much, I'm 100% sure about, but I've never gone back to Jukai, and I never will.
Part 4. The Murderer Meets the Journalist. For decades, rumors surrounding Jukai claimed that the forest was a dumping place for murder victims of the Yakuza. These rumors have been debunked, as it would be too difficult to carry a body through the forest when there were so many simpler ways to dispose of a murder victim. Others claim that gangster groups like the Yakuza had an initiation ritual to kill someone in Jukai before being admitted. Those have also been proven to be nothing but fanciful tales. What about psychopaths like in the previous tale? These also lack any proof, though proof may be hard to find if such individuals do exist. Journalist Ramu, introduced in previous episodes, addresses the rumors that murders look for hikers and suicidal people. Although he does not personally believe the rumors that there are psychopathic people hunters there, he also admits that he never takes chances. He never hikes alone in Jukai. After more than 100 visits to the forest, he has heard disturbing details from police, such as corpses found to have been mutilated or set on fire after death. He thinks people who would be capable of doing that may be capable of many evils, but it is his own personal experience that has him convinced that murders do occur in the forest. He himself was almost a victim, and thus he has proof that murders do occur in Jukai. His story is almost beyond belief.
So I'm sitting in a car with two editors and a man who identified himself only as Mr. M. After reading my articles about Jukai, Mr. M asked the magazine if I could write a story for a project. "What is this project?" I had asked. One of the editors answered, "It's called Visit the Scene of the Crime with the Murderer." That was a week ago. Once I got over the shock of the assignment, I agreed. And now I'm sitting in the backseat of a car with the murderer while my two editors sit up front. I look over at Mr. M. The convicted criminal wears an old black coat. He appears to be in his mid-30s. I have to assume the man paid for his crimes and learned his lesson. Otherwise, they would not have let him out of jail, right? But something about that aggressive, carnivorous face bothers me. It sends shivers down my spine. And Mr. M is always smiling. It's that creepy smile, like you think he's just wondering what he's going to do to you. He also laughs too frequently, unnervingly. Just sitting next to Mr. M, I feel uncomfortable. I could never have imagined at that moment that in a few short hours I myself would be on the brink of death. I start the interview in the car by asking about Mr. M's background. Here's what he said.
"I was part of an operation that ran a telephone dating service. I made good money. Then our operation was threatened by someone from a competing, well, let's just call it a club, right? So I had to strike first. I tortured him in city and then brought him to Jukai and killed him here."
He says this nonchalantly with a wicked smile. Not a shred of remorse crosses his face. A shiver runs through me. I want to just open the car door and jump out of the moving car. But I put aside my initial shock at this confession and say, it must have been hard to actually kill someone, even if you really hated him.
"No, no. Not at all. I never hesitated. I was in charge of torturing and killing these kinds of people for a long time as part of our club, our gang. We had renovated a small building and I had to do various unsavory things, almost on a daily basis. So I had no qualms about killing. None at all."
I now understand exactly what type of job Mr. M had at the telephone dating service. He had been some sort of enforcer.
"You know, the ili is that your only crime the police charged me with was interfering with a corpse. I want to bury it as a demonstration. You know, as a warning against other gang, you can't dig in the ground at Yukai. It's all hard lava rock, not even a meter of soil. I had to give up. So I didn't report it properly and went to jail. I have to admit, that was a failure on my part.
I listen silently as the car pulls into a convenience store to rest area. One of the editors runs inside for food, leaving me and the remaining editor in the car with Mr. M while we sit alone, Mr. Mess says.
The guy I killed at the time, I got caught. He was a lively guy, very energetic, real spunk. Even after I hit him and cut him, I couldn't break him. He just smiled and laughed at me. So how do you break a guy like that? You eat part of him. That's what you do. I'll shave off some meat from his leg or arm while he watches, and then I'll eat it raw right in front of him. That will break anyone, no matter how strong they are. Let me tell you, the other way to break them is to kill their family right in front of them. People say, why do you kill the family if only Dice Hilf was bad? The answer is simple. We don't care. The family ate and lived off the money he skimmed and stole. So they drove it to two. We just don't get into that way of thinking. They're all bad guys. I'll eat part of them, kill them, whatever.
I just sit there in stunned silence with pounding heart. I am wondering if I can just quit this interview now and find my own way home. At that point, I think, I'll walk home if I have to. Unable to take this talk any longer, I excuse myself to use the restroom. Relief floods over me as I step away from the car. I am still fighting my revulsion when I return a few minutes later. We are all standing outside the car. The editor is giving Mr. M some yakisoba noodles and Mr. M slurps them up. When I see this, I cannot shake the thought of him eating raw human flesh. As if reading my mind, he says with another one of those wicked smiles,
I love yakisoba. This is good stuff.
I want nothing more than to return to Tokyo, but I force myself to get in the car and watch as the editor points the driver to the road to Jukai. Normally, reporter instincts take hold, and I will ask a barrage of questions. But I remain quiet as we drive down the road in a valley of trees. I am just playing a silly game on the cell phone to avoid further awkward conversations. Mr. M makes a call that turns into a heated exchange. Just before hanging up, Mr. M screams into the phone,
I'll kill you.
This happens again with another phone call. Neither myself nor the other editors comment on it. The inside of the car exudes an ominous and quiet atmosphere. I know we can all feel it. Once we reach Jukai, I quickly exit the car. I feel like we have arrived too late in the day to be here with someone like this, even with two editors. What are they exactly? Witnesses. Mr. Emmy takes this opportunity to start his story.
So we came here at midnight, when no one was harmed. He was still alive at the time. It was just me, my subordinates, and the person I was going to kill. We didn't want to kill him ahead of time, because it would be impossible to carry the body to Jukai. Just too much trouble. It was also pitch black, so we couldn't see. Even flashlights don't provide much illumination. Once we go into the trees, everything is just darker inside, right?
Just 100 yards in, Mr. M takes off of the main trail and into the trees. After a while, he stops and looks around, shining the flashlight to check his bearings.
It's just so hard to navigate it in here. Imagine it being dark and your flashlight doesn't let you see the ground so well, right? I don't recall exactly where, but I think it was here.
He is looking up at the tree, squinting. One of the editors says, why don't you recreate the crime for us to see how you did it? You can pretend Ramu is the man you killed. I take a step back in shock, hands raised in front of me. Are you crazy? What are you saying? Did they not realize that we are standing there with a self-professed murderer at the scene of the crime? And they want me to roleplay the murder victim with the actual killer. The editors urge me to cooperate. Come on, it will make a better story. We're both here. You're safe. I fight back the fear. I figure there are two witnesses, and there is still a little light out. Okay, I say, but immediately regret my capitulation. Mr. Mem's face takes on a beastly smile.
Let's do this then.
I feel like screaming and running, but I just stand there mutely. Mr. M takes my shoulders and maneuvers me into position. he tells me to stand back to back with him, so I turn around and face the tree. My back is to Mr. M and the two editors. I can hear Mr. M doing something behind me, but I can't tell what it might be. Interesting, one of the editors comments. That disturbs me, but I don't know why. And I don't know what Mr. M is doing behind me. But I find out a few moments later. Mr. M grunts and then moves very quickly. A looped rope suddenly falls down in front of me. He has thrown it over a heavy bough above. I clearly see that he has tied a noose to the end and just flopped down on the ground in front of me. Mr. M reaches around me, grabs the noose end of the rope and loops it around my neck. He does this so fast, so skillfully with experience, that I don't even have time to protest or say anything. When I turn around, my fear amplifies to terror. Mr. Eam holds the other end of the rope in both hands.
Now we just have to get them hanging.
I am thinking, great, demonstration over. You told us how you did it. No such luck for me. Mr. M suddenly pushes forward with great force. It was a maneuver I have seen in judo tournaments. First, I feel the rope around my neck pull up and go taut. Then I feel myself strangling, my body lifts off the ground. My toes are not even touching. That's when I realize this is no joke. Instinctively, I pinch my fingers between the rope and my neck. That was the only way I could think of to secure an airway. My legs are kicking and my toes touch a rock, but all my weight is supported by my neck. And then Mr. Aim pulls even harder, and even my toes lose purchase. Now, as anyone can guess, Mr. M is a large, strong man. He doesn't get to be an enforcer and do the things he does by being weak. So he continues applying pressure, pulling forward as he takes another step and then two. He is stepping toward the editors. My vision is blurring, so I don't even know what they are thinking or doing. My legs are kicking. My mind is racing. I'm thinking, is Mr. M seriously going to kill me just for sport? Just to show off to these two editors? My fingers are no longer able to hold open an airway at my neck. I find that I simply can't breathe even a little bit. I kick forward with great strength, flopping like a grounded fish. This is my reflexive response to survive being activated. This is the end, I think. The panic and pain are beyond comprehension. My only thoughts are, I walked right into it. I'm so stupid. Then the panic is all-encompassing, and I cannot think at all. Spots pop up in my vision, white blinking spots. My lungs burn to gasp for air that would not come. The pressure in my head feels like it will explode. I'm still kicking wildly, and my body is jerking violently from top to bottom. Just as suddenly as it started, Mr. M releases the rope, and I fall forward. I crouch there on my knees, violently inhaling air, trying to force it in. For a few moments, it is like hyperventilating through a straw. A rattling sound comes from the back of my throat. Miss Neem looks down at me and smiles that wicked smile he had been flashing all day.
Sorry, I thought you were more manly kind. Even the die I killed was more dignified than you. You are pussy, yeah.
And then he laughs as if it is all some big joke. I try to fake a laugh. I guess it was my pride. But then I just wheeze and gasp. I don't speak at all as we begin the trek back to the car. I won't even stand near Mr. M after that stunt. I won't even look at him during the walk back to the car. I feel overcome with nausea, and I think I might vomit. By the time we reach the car, I have calmed myself down. Regaining composure, I tell myself, I need to act like a reporter, not a victim. I speak for the first time in a long time. So is there anything in the forest that scares you? Mr. M flashes his creepy smile at me, but it seems tinged with something else. Could it be fear?
I'm scared of these spirits.
This surprises me almost as the near-death experience. I expected Mr. M to say that nothing scared him. Here was a man who admitted torturing and killing people and even cannibalized their raw meat as the victim watched. He did all this with some sense of mirth, yet ghosts scared him. I said, spirits, do you mean ghosts of people you killed because they have a grudge against you?
No, you idiot. Don't be stupid. I'm not afraid of someone I killed. If they were weaker than me in life and became a spirit, they can't do anything to me after they're gone. They're pussies, just like you were.
I just swallow my pride and ignore the insults. This was just Mr. M's manner of speaking. I say, so what's so scary about a spirit?
I'm talking about those spirits we Throngai power. Those Throng, well, maybe they were not even a human to begin with. Maybe they are demons. They are something born from nature itself. They are big, white, scary ghosts or entities.
I notice with surprise that Mr. M is actually trembling as he says this, having dropped his bravado in a moment of reflection. After we drop off Mr. M, I start having regrets. I should have followed up on the discussion about the spirits and demons that seem to haunt Mr. M. But I think I was just too elated that Mr. M is gone. The mood in the car lightens up once he is gone. He is one of those people who just seems to carry an aura of evil about him. And then everything he does and says reinforces that atmosphere. Soon after the interview, police arrest and incarcerate Mr. M. I don't know if he ever got out of prison again. I hope not, but I secretly hope that spirits and demons torment this evil man in prison and that he stays there his entire life.
This was proof positive that murder happens in the forest. Maybe visitors don't have to worry about psychopaths hunting them down, but if they are ever led to the forest by a killer, they know that murders staged to look like suicides happen there too. Perhaps even stranger than murders at Jukai are groups of people called corpse hunters and the morbid proclivities of some who visit the forest for other nefarious reasons. We explore that and more in the next episode.
This has been Mysterious Japan, created, written, and translated by Heath Havey. Thank you for listening and making this podcast possible. Please visit our website at www.themysteriousjapan.com for more information. Please join us next time as we continue to explore the dark histories and strange mysteries of Japan.